Welcome to the weekly-ish podcast of the Restoration Project, a progressive, cooperative Baptist fellowship church located in Salisbury, Maryland. What you are about to hear is a nerdy Bible conversation about one of the four assigned passages in the Revised Common Lectionary, the very same lectionary passage that is the focus in our kids' ministry for the week. We hope the episode will provide listeners with a taste of what we do in our Sunday morning sermon conversations, and we hope it provides parents with some additional background information should their kids ask them really good questions about our ancient sacred text. Here are this week's hosts.
What's up, people, and welcome to another episode of the TRP podcast. I'm Josh. I'm one of the pastors, and for 2 weeks in a row now, I am joined by
Laura Rogers.
I didn't know if I was going to say it or you were going to say it, but I'm glad that you did,
because elder extraordinaire.
There you are.
Longest serving, maybe.
Probably all told. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah, you did take a little bit of time off there, so I don't know if you're. Current term is the longest tenured, but all told, yes.
Yes.
All time. Okay, this one's going to be weird because this story is so familiar. I didn't do a whole lot of preparing, and I don't have a whole lot of notes, and I don't know where this conversation is going to go.
Let's decide at the end if it's weird.
Okay. Again, we have made this point, I think in every episode we've done in this reboot. The lectionary is frustrating because the text that it has selected for us is at the very end of a 3-chapter cycle of the flood story. So we're getting the very end of this climactic and devastating moment of destruction. And these are the words that we are meant to meditate and contemplate on. They come from Genesis chapter 9, verses 8 through 17. I would encourage folks to maybe get on a Bible app or get a real book in your hands and read Genesis 6 through 9 to get the larger context of the story. But here's our text for this episode. It says, "Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him." And again, this is after Noah has built the boat, gathered his family, gathered some animals. The flood story is the programmatic example for what is called source criticism in Old Testament studies. So there was this guy named, we didn't get many words into the text, did we, until I started riffing?
No.
Here we go. There's this guy named Julius Wellhausen. He was a German historical critic, Bible scholar, and he was reading the Pentateuch, and when he was doing that, he started seeing patterns in the text that allowed him to theorize different sources that had been spliced together to create Genesis through Deuteronomy. So, for example, you've got Genesis 1, which is a creation story that sort of depicts God as over and above all things. God is transcendent. God is calling things into existence and not really getting God's hands dirty in any way, shape, or form. There's a lot of order as well. It's repetitive. And then when you get to Genesis chapter 2, a lot of things change. The depiction of God changes where God is literally taking the dust of the earth and forming a human out of it and then breathing God's own breath into the body of this dust creature. It's a very different depiction of God. God is an artist. God is getting God's hands dirty. God is very much involved in the nitty-gritty. God is wanting to take strolls around the garden with Adam. Like, God is invested in a way that God is not invested in Genesis chapter 1. Also, God has different names in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. So Wellhausen, he wasn't the first one to propose this, but he said, these are probably two different traditions written by different people and brought together in their current form. The flood story, if you do read it from Genesis 6 through 9, you'll find that there are a good handful of inconsistencies or tensions or contradictions in the way that the story is told. And when you separate out potential sources, you can make two freestanding flood stories that can stand independent of each other. It's wild.
That's really interesting.
So a lot of times people will go to Genesis 6 through 9 as this programmatic example of source theory that Wellhausen popularized in the late 1800s or so. And it was a bombshell, because up to that point, people sort of had this idea that Moses wrote the Pentateuch. But there's been a lot of pushback on that when you do a... I would just say, when you read the Bible, this is true of Genesis, this is true of the Gospels. When you read the Bible, problems arise.
Sure.
Namely, problems of consistency and contradiction and tension, and you got to figure out a way to talk about them. Okay, so flood story, Genesis 9. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "As for me, I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the domestic animals, and every animal of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark. I establish my covenant with you, that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." God said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations." Get that. The language is really, it's a one-sided covenant and it's a forever covenant. Okay? And this is the sign. "I have set my bow in the clouds." Does that strike you as weird? "I have set my bow in the clouds"?
No, because... if this story is to be believed that it is as it's written, rain wasn't really a thing. So to call it a rainbow, I don't know. That's off the cuff.
Rain definitely had been a thing a couple chapters prior, when it's like
but that's
destroying the earth.
Yes. But is that not the first?
Yeah. There's a lot of that that's happening.
Okay.
And actually, you could even make the case that, so going back to Genesis 1, the cosmology is... there's a lot of water, and God has to separate the waters.
Yeah.
So God makes an expanse, which is not a helpful term. Does that word mean anything to you, just as a normal American reader? What's an expanse?
A big space.
Yeah, I would think like outer space.
Yeah.
I think there's a show called The Expanse.
I don't know.
Okay, I think it's a sci-fi show. Yeah, that's not really what is being described here. The Hebrew term is rakia. And it comes from a verb form that means like to lay out flat and to hammer out, like you're hammering out a sheet of metal almost, like you're forming something. So picture just a bunch of water and then sort of like a roof or a dome, or like you're now inside of a snow globe and there's some water in there with you, but there's a ceiling up there. And then there's stuff outside of the ceiling, the rakia, the expanse, and it's more water. So God is separating the waters from above and the waters from below. And then later, when the flood happens, it doesn't just start raining. The floodgates open up, and it's almost like the rakia, the dome, the roof, has skylights that God opens, and the waters above that have been separated pour back in. Is that land? Like, are we getting the image here?
Yeah.
So it's not just like, oh, here's some storm clouds and some rain. It's this ancient, the word I want to say is inaccurate,
yeah,
depiction of this flood that's utilizing some Genesis imagery of creation, where there's this roof that's keeping the waters above out there somewhere until God wants to reintroduce them. This is also an important part of the story, because in Genesis 1, God is ordering all things, creating order, removing chaos by separating all the waters. And then in the flood, God is reintroducing chaos to destroy what has been created because God wants to start all over again.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is good. It's their best attempt to explain science they don't understand yet.
Yes, and I don't want us to posture as culturally arrogant. We have satellites and we're the smarty pantses, right?
Right.
We don't know much either. We only know what we're able to know, but their understanding of the world was very different than our understanding of the world. So, and I hope we're not getting too far afield here. At least the scholars that I've been reading on the flood for the last handful of years would say it is likely that a rain event happened, and it is likely that the ancient people thought that the rain event covered the entire landscape of the known world.
Yeah.
Because they had no concept of a circular earth. They had no concept of what they couldn't see. They're not traveling far distances. There's no phones. You know, it's like, so they're sort of locked into their own space. So when this massive weather event takes place, they sort of depict it in their mind as a global catastrophic flood because their globe, in quotes, their earth, in quotes, was destroyed through this weather event that was unprecedented at the time.
Sure. It makes perfect sense.
What I was really asking you there, though, is the word bow is different than the word rainbow.
It is. I was just postulating that they didn't have a concept of rain until very recently.
Yeah. I just think the way that the story is okay. The one note that I do have here is, the flood is not a kid's story! Exclamation point.
I think it's because of all, it's like a zoo situation.
Yes. So like nurseries are outfitted with animals on a boat, and you got a giraffe head, you know, coming out of the windows of the ark. It's cute and fluffy and whatever. And then a rainbow with a couple clouds. Like, I can just picture it. And everything's cutesy and animated and cartoony.
On the felt board.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the image that sort of lives in our brain space as we read this text, or better, as we think about this text. But the term, I mean, it's a bow. It's a weapon. It's an implement of war. And God is hanging God's bow on the hook to never use it again. You know? That's very different than, oh, it's a beautiful rainbow. And you know, every time that we have a rainbow, somebody's posting on Facebook a picture of a rainbow and saying, like, God is so good. You know what I mean?
And we'll never have a worldwide flood again.
Not the image that's, you know, you'd be better off going in somebody's hunting closet and finding their, I don't know how to talk about weapons in a knowledgeable way, like their bow.
Their bow. Yeah. That's
I just wanted to be more specific, like their whatever gauge bow and pulleys and
no, bow's good.
Okay, thanks. That's the image, which makes sense in the ancient world because the divine is not going to war against the people anymore. It's not rainbowy. Here's something I did hear that was interesting. And I don't really know what to do with this because I don't see it a lot in commentaries, but I remember it from lectures in seminary. The image of a rainbow, like picture it, I don't know bow terminology, but like the pull string on a bow, if you were to pull that down, the arrow would go up.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is where in the ancient mindset, God lives. So some people have thought that this is sort of like, it's called a self-maledictory oath, where the divine is promising to not flood the earth. And if the divine breaks that promise, the bow would be pulled on the divine itself and they would die. So it's like the, remember the bit when Abraham is making a covenant with God and they get all those animals and they cut them in two.
Blood trench.
Yeah, and they split them on either side, and they walk down the middle, except Abraham doesn't walk down the middle because Abraham is put to sleep, and God hovers down the middle in a like a cauldron and a flaming torch.
Mm-hmm.
Weird image, but like only God is the one who goes down this aisle, as if to say, I won't break this covenant, and if I do, you can do to me what we have done to these animals. Like, so God is covenanting with God's own self.
It's his covenant with us.
That God will, according to this play anyway, God will die if God breaks this covenant.
Yeah, it's not a covenant we have with each other. It's a covenant that God is making with us.
Now listen to this, because it gets weird. All right. I've set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. Who's remembering? God. I will remember. Not the people. The rainbow is for God to remember, not for us.
That's insane. I have never...
Suck it, Facebook. You are wrong again.
I have never thought about that. And it's like, you know, the whole thing where there's all these examples in the Bible of God changing it, God's mind, and people even talking God into changing God's mind. And here you have... You know what? I probably need a reminder. So I'm...
Now, I don't want to completely diminish the reminder for the people, but you have to at least say that God is also the recipient of the reminder, the post-it note, if you will, not to kill everyone.
Yeah, you do. It's very clear in the writing. How I don't know how I've missed it.
I know. Because
the felt board.
Well, no, we don't read the Bible. We think we know the Bible stories because we've heard this one forever.
Yes.
Which is also why when you do that source criticism stuff, you'll start seeing things like, how long did it rain? Because in one spot it says 40 days, and another spot I think it's like 150 days, and how many animals were brought? Because in one spot it's like 2 by 2. In another spot it's 7 pairs of clean and different numbers for unclean.
Yeah.
It's like, so. And you got all, like, and how long did they have to wait for the waters to recede? Because in one spot it's this and one. And again, if you separate it out, they make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Because they're not being spliced together. But yeah, I don't say this of like you, literally you, Laura, sitting across the table from me, but the generalized you don't know this because we're not reading it with much intentionality. And I'm putting myself in that spot too. I did feel really good because somebody was going off about, I went to college with them. Somebody was going off about this on Facebook about this particular thing. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, the reminder is actually for God. And I knew that was going to push a lot of buttons because immediately think, well, God doesn't need to be reminded of everything. Except when God's saying that God needs to be reminded of something.
Yeah.
You know?
Because you people push me to the edge, and I'm going to need a reminder that I said I wouldn't kill all of you.
Yes. Okay. I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all the flesh, and the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. The word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Why on God's green earth are we reading this story to children? Again. The backstory is, we're talking about this passage from the lectionary because this is the passage that has been selected by our kids' curriculum for the kids to learn. So we want the adults and the kids learning the same stuff, which is great. And I've got no real beef with the kids' curriculum that we're using. It's great. I appreciate it. It asks a lot of good questions. It's not super dogmatic. It's not literalistic. But why would we say, you know, let's just go ahead and let the kids continue to hear this thing that people are deconstructing from 20 years down the road? Right. When you think of deconstruction, it's this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Because one day you roll out of bed and you say, huh, all those cutesy animals on the boat, they were the only ones that lived. And those handful of people that were in there with them, everyone else died. And why did they die? Oh, you see, because the angels were having sex with the women and creating giants, right? It's like, what? It's insanity. The better part about that bit is God is so grieved that God has created humans that God then resorts to flooding the earth, which think theologically, it's a, I want to say an uncreation and a recreation, a decreation. I don't know the right word there. A decreation and a recreation. It's,
I believe the technical term is redo.
Yes, right. I'll take a mulligan. So if you're reading it in consistently with, you know, the creation story, it's like God's creating stuff, everything's good, and then it just gets bad and worse and terrible, and then God feels something not pleasant. God is grieved, which again doesn't fit with our over theological views of who God is. Namely, God knows everything, God isn't surprised by anything, God isn't grieved by stuff because God's planned for all of the things, and God doesn't need to be reminded of anything because God knows all the things all the time, except, as we said earlier, when you read the Bible, problems arise. Namely, to your understanding of the Bible and of God.
Yeah.
Let me ask this. Do you think that Genesis is providing us with a true depiction of God's ontological nature? Meaning, does God really grieve, risk, not know, is surprised, or is the story depicting God in a way that makes the most sense to us as human readers?
I would roll the dice. I think that it's important for humans to feel like things are relatable. And so if you go with option two that you presented, it makes God more relatable because the Genesis 1 God is not relatable, but that God is mystical and worthy of awe and worship. And so you sort of have to, it just depends on who's telling the story, I think. The people who want God to be this big, mysterious, all-knowing God, or the people that want God to be a God who's more relatable.
Yeah, there's this big, I don't know if it's big in the real world or if it's big on the algorithms of my social media pages, but there's a movement called process theology that, and I'm going to butcher this, but you know, you can Google it or just listen to any episode from Homebrewed Christianity. This is like their thing. God is in relationship with people, and God's knowledge is limited to whatever current moment we are in time. So like what happens in the future, God doesn't necessarily know how we will choose, what paths we will choose to go down. I think it's fair to say that some people would say that God knows all the potential paths, but God doesn't know which paths we'll choose. This kind of stuff makes my brain hurt because I'm not a philosopher and I'm not a theologian. But one of the reasons why process theologians exist, I think, and another subclass of these people is open and relational theology, why it exists is because the problem of evil makes no sense to us if God has known all the things and all the things are set in stone.
Yeah, you can't make it work.
So the Holocaust was known and was set in stone, and God was sort of above it all. And we say, well, God allowed it. God didn't do it. God allowed it, which doesn't help anybody.
No, and it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit.
And when you're saying it doesn't fit what?
With a loving God.
I agree. I know there are people that would say, well, sure it does, because God is just, or God is whatever, sovereign, or fill in the blank with whatever theological word they want to use there to explain away the difficulty that is taking place in the world.
I mean, it could just be that my brain's too finite, and that most are.
I don't want to make their brains more infinite. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that's what's happening. I just think that they're somehow more okay with God being involved in mass casualty. So, I mean, their reading of the flood story is like, well, yeah, I mean, God destroyed the earth because the people deserved it.
I have no problem viewing God in significant amounts of grief during the flood or the Holocaust or XYZ. I don't think it makes any less God.
Well, I'm with you. I mean, I would counter and say, and I wouldn't push this on anyone, but for me to accept a God who is not grieving what is clearly grievable makes God less God.
Yeah.
Like, what do I want to do with that guy? No thanks.
Yeah.
If we're cool, just like with mass genocide, if that's all right, I'm sort of done here. You know? So I have to make sense. And I don't, maybe at the end of the day, we're all trying to put the cards in an
order that helps us sleep.
Yeah. That yeah. helps us to understand what's going on in the world. But I just can't think, even of the small tragedies that I've experienced in my own life, I can't get on board with, oh, this is God's good and sovereign plan from before the foundations of the earth for this person to die in this way at this time, and I'm just meant to be thankful.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
No.
And sometimes it comes off like, I mean, I could even, as I was even saying that, I can see people and hear people diminishing my faith or my commitments or my whatever, mm-hmm. like as if this other theological view that sees God as this punisher, that's where we should all be striving to get. We should all be striving to get to a place where that makes sense to us. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't like that. No.
It's such a mind meld, which is why let's just not introduce these stories to the children, because let's just not force them to wrestle with the ugliness of the world and God's role in it.
But what's wrong if we say this made God terribly sad?
At some point, the kickback is going to be, but why did God feel that God's only option was to open the floodgates and kill everybody? And why was Noah the only one to survive? And I know it says that Noah was righteous, but it doesn't say what Noah did.
Yeah, what equals to get righteous. That.
And
yeah.
if Noah is earning something there, if Noah's righteousness is allowing him not to die, how is that not proposing like some sort of works-based? Like whenever you say works-based in Christian circles, that's like demonized. Like works-based is the devil. Like you, that's not, it's grace. You do nothing because you are nothing. You're worth nothing. You have nothing to offer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can tell I'm traumatized by this, right?
Because, yeah, a little bit.
It none of it makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I fear that at some point the kids will have these sorts of responses. Now, you know, when they do, we'll deal with them. And we'll say stuff like, yeah, that's tough. I have no idea. And I might throw in something like, I don't necessarily even think this story is historical. So that helps a little bit because I don't think this really happened. I don't think everybody did die.
No, me either.
Or all the animals.
The people in this little area might have had some trouble.
I remember working at a Christian school and they invited in the Answers in Genesis people and they had a lecture, and this makes me so mad, had a lecture from someone with a degree from Harvard, which is fine. I'm not anti-Harvard, but their degree was in like advanced math, and they're talking about science and theology and posturing as Harvard-educated theologians or Bible scholars. That makes me mad.
Were they discussing probability?
No, they were saying things like, how did all of the animals fit on the ark? Well, they were baby animals. Which they didn't learn that at Harvard in their math classes. You know what I mean? It's like, ugh. That's my own thing that I do need to work out in counseling. But it's like, for impressionable young people, it's like, oh, they must be smart because they went to Harvard. Therefore, whatever they say must hold water. Even if they're saying patently ridiculous things about juvenile animals fitting on the ark and dinosaurs being a part of that.
Stop it.
So we just...
Oh, I don't mean to laugh, people.
I don't even know. I don't know where to go with that. I do think, coming back to the, this story is not historical, it didn't happen, therefore we're off the hook, can really only get us so far, because it's still in our sacred text as a story that's meant to tell us something about God.
Yeah.
And so if I was back there with the kids, I would probably introduce some of these ideas about the flood story. Because if you're going to understand the flood story, you have to go outside of the Bible in order to understand it. Because this is one example, and again, like, the flood story is the programmatic example of source criticism. It's also the programmatic example of ancient Near Eastern shared stories. This is not the only ancient flood story in existence.
No.
And of the ancient flood stories that exist, Genesis is one of the later ones. Like, there's one called Atrahasis. There's one called the Gilgamesh Epic. They both predate Genesis, and they're so similar that in this instance, it seems like it's at least conceivable that Genesis is borrowing ideas from these other myths that exist in their known world.
Yeah.
Other times, scholars might want to say the similarities amongst stories are, it's just indicative of people breathing the same air. It's not ancient scribe looking at open text of Atrahasis and open text of Gilgamesh and then writing Genesis. You know what I mean?
Yes, I understand.
It's just like shared stories, shared myth, and Genesis being, in this instance, a polemic against the theology that is propositioned in Atrahasis and Gilgamesh. For example, in the Atrahasis story, the gods want to destroy the world because the humans are, quote, making too much noise. So they destroy, or they try to destroy everything, but Atrahasis is able to escape because Atrahasis makes a boat. And Atrahasis makes a boat that's very similar to the boat in the Genesis story, which is wild. And in the Genesis story, clearly God is not destroying the world because God is ticked off at the noise down below. God is grieved. The people's wickedness has increased to exorbitant levels. God has no other, according to the story, no other course of action. God is pained by this. Like, it's just a very different theological take. So in one story, it's like sort of these petty and petulant gods that just want to off everybody because they're too loud. And the Genesis story is, while still difficult, different in the depiction of God.
Yeah.
It's also important to remember, you know, we were talking earlier about this water event that takes place, that at least a good handful of the folks that I've been reading would say it's likely that the flood stories in the ancient world were originally penned to make sense of a reality that has happened in their world, right? So weather event happens, flooding happens, people die, and now we have to sort of figure out why.
Yeah.
So it's less of a story about how and bullet point it, mm-hmm. and more a story about why. This is the same thing about the creation stories, which is why the answers in Genesis people are so infuriating, because they're just, in my estimation, misreading the Bible very much.
Grossly.
Thank you. It's not meant to be read as a scientific step-by-step, literal day one, day two, day... That's not the point. The point is more, why did God create? Not how God created, but like, why? What's the purpose? And what do we learn about humanity? And what do we learn about God? And what's the purpose? Mm-hmm. You know? So humans being invested with the divine image, which is very different than these other ancient stories, because humanity, according to Genesis, is meant to rule in God's stead on the earth. It's a very high view of humanity.
Yeah.
It's not... We need to create these less than divine beings, these humans, these peons, to do all of our work. And when they get too loud, we'll just kill them. That's the other stories. And Genesis is sort of pushing back on some of those ideas and creating a different image of humanity. Like, the people that are dying are image bearers of the Most High God who have gone off the rails. And while we would want some redemptive, you know, qualities, salvation in some way, a restitution, a turn, a repentance, this story is also just sort of playing on, it's a decreation and a recreation. But the image of humanity and the image of God is so different than these other stories that it's at least worth sitting with. So I think it'd be fun, and I've done this with my kids, and my kids are probably going to be screwed, but... Like introducing an Atrahasis character, or in Gilgamesh, it's not Gilgamesh who is the flood survivor. It's a guy named Utnapishtim, I believe, who's like, I think he's sort of depicted as like this old kook who's been around for a long time, and he's gained immortality because he survived this flood, and Gilgamesh wants to go talk to him and talk about what he needs to do to gain immortality as well. So setting Genesis within the landscape of all these other stories as well, and seeing how they're telling different versions of God and the world and humans, and why the Bible's version is different and, I would say, compelling. How do you think that would go?
I love that, because people lived through some sort of flood. There was physical evidence of it, even for generations, you know, like shells fossilized way up higher than the ocean should be. There has to be an explanation. And so they're looking for what happened here and why. And they're coming up with all these different people groups are coming up with different theories. And I love that ours is one of just like the creation story, one of at least an effort to make God seem careful and as though he wasn't just on a whim saying, I'm scrapping this. I got to start over.
Do you think, I hadn't really thought about this until right now. And just to preface it, I'm fine with it. Okay.
Okay.
But do you think that this sort of look at all these other stories and examples of people trying to make sense of the divine in the best way that they know how, according to where they are and what they're doing, do you think that that opens up the door for larger, maybe even entire religious systems that are different from Christianity being, let's say, equally valid theological expressions of this thing that none of us can really wrap our hands around?
Do you mean in terms of trying to get your head around the flood event, or
no,
in general?
No, so I mean, like, does the fact that the flood event and the different stories and how we can like compare and contrast. Mm-hmm. And while we would probably privilege Genesis because it's our known language, it's our sacred text, it's what we've grown up with, we can see why these other stories may have existed.
Yes.
And what they meant in different contexts.
Sure.
Does that open up the door for us saying something like, well, I probably think what I think because I grew up on a pig farm in Laurel, Delaware, and I went to Epworth Christian School, and then I went to Bible college, and I've known a lot of American Christians, and if I was born somewhere else, I would think very different things about the divine, and that is not because I'm right and they're wrong, but because of our situations and circumstances and God revealing God's self in different ways to different people at different times.
Yes, I would say if that hasn't occurred to you, then you're not doing a lot of thinking.
You understand.
I'm not saying that
how volatile people would be hearing you say that, right?
Yeah, I do. But I think if it hasn't at least occurred to you as a possibility, then you, I don't even know what to say about that. You're the people you surround yourself in, the culture you're raised in, the traditions of your family of origin, it shapes you. And you don't have a choice about that.
What would you do? This has nothing to do with the flood story. We've gone way past
yes.
this. What if one of your two beautiful, loving sons comes to you and says, you know what? I don't think the Christian tradition speaks to me as much as fill in the blank.
Yeah. I'm not going to act like I'm not going to be upset about that. And by upset, I mean sad, or to use a word we've been using tonight, grieved.
Yeah.
Because I do think I would prize it above all others, but I don't think that I necessarily believe it for that reason. It's just what has been and what is for me, given my
yeah
location and my surroundings and the, you know, it just is.
A friend of mine once said, and I don't think I'm at a place of pure agreement, but I understand what he means now more than I did then, I think. He's an atheist, but he would say, but culturally I'm a Christian, meaning I like the stories and I like the holidays and I like my family and I like to do these things.
Yeah.
But I don't believe them.
I think most atheists would fall into that category.
And honestly, like the whole kid thing, that's one of the more, I can't say this with certainty because I haven't lived it yet. My kids are processing things. They're sharp little guys that have big thoughts, and Kate and I aren't necessarily worried about where they are at this very moment. But as of now, they still like to come with us to church.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Christmas Eve is Christmas Eve and Easter is Easter, and our family rhythms and routines, we can all be together. And if one of them were to say, this other thing speaks to my, to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes them away from Christmas and Easter, and you know what I mean? That
yeah.
would be a really big thing, more so than the I believe they're going to hell now. You know what I mean? Like
yes.
that's not the issue so much as it is the I like people sharing things that I like.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Which saying
yeah.
that out loud sounds kind of selfish.
No, it doesn't. It's a huge part of any culture, I would think. That's not specific to us.
Yeah. Now, I feel like we've done a lot with this story. I don't know if there's a whole lot left there to unravel. I do want to circle back and say, even if I still don't know why they would have picked this text, but the kids' curriculum is basically there's the passage and then a bunch of discussion questions. You were back there with them not too long ago with the new curriculum, true, false?
Yes.
Okay. So the kid curriculum questions are things like, what questions or feelings do you have after hearing this story? Which I love, because mm-hmm. it allows them space to process. Like, why is God mean? Why does God have to remind God's self not to kill everybody? I don't think they would get there, because I don't think they know all the ins and outs of the story, but it's at least there for them to say. Also, God's promise at the end of this story, and I love how they word this, there will always be an end to the rain. Like, that's the promise. They say that can bring us hope. How does knowing there will be an end to the rain bring you hope?
Yeah, that's
so that's
great.
Good.
Yeah.
Right, so we've moved away from the there's baby animals on the ark and that's how they all fit. Stop asking me these questions, kid. Mm-hmm. You know, to really dealing with the theological stuff. And this is true for an ancient reader. It's like the whole point of the rainbow and whatever we gain from that is this sense of confidence that whatever bad happens, it won't be that bad, or it won't be bad to the full, right? There's this little glimmer of hope out there on the horizon. And honestly, I feel like that's the kind of stuff that makes Christianity and Judaism compelling still, you know?
Yeah.
These stories to then extrapolate big springboards for questions about how are you thinking about God in light of this story? And what gives you hope?
That's what I was going to say. It offers such unbelievable hope. Even after it's just discussed the killing of almost everyone.
Which I guess I would still want to push, like, that's a literary device.
Sure, but when you're six.
Yes, although even six-year-olds watch things that include death, right?
Yeah, sure.
Like, my kids are super into Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
It's like some kids have point of contact with that. Some probably less so, but Harry Potter even. Like, kids stuff includes the realities of life and death. It does up the ante a bit when you're wrestling with the Bible, because in some traditions you're not allowed to ask the same questions about the Bible as you are Harry Potter, which is unfortunate. Oh, the flood. Whew. It's a great space to nerd out on any number of ancient Near Eastern things. Its theology to this day, I'm 42, is still difficult.
Yeah, but so, gosh, I'm way back at the beginning of this talk at the bow pointed toward God.
Yeah, there's
so great, there's, and him hanging it up not to be used again.
That's another ancient Near Eastern image that's, I won't say ripped off, but same sort of
borrowed.
Yeah, there's other images of other warriors putting their implements of war away. I've gained so much from a deeper dive into those parallels with the Bible and other ancient Near Eastern stories, or, you know, other Jewish traditions that are outside of the text, where it's like, man, if we do believe that God is revealing God's self to people in ways that make sense to them,
mm-hmm.
that gives me hope that God continues to reveal God's self to me in a way that makes sense now in my 21st century American context.
Yeah, it puts you in the mind of the author. And to me, that's where you want to be.
Okay, well, speaking of the Old Testament, we're going to keep going with Genesis chapter 17 next week, a little Abrahamic covenant. And you will be joined by me and Susie for a different change of pace. But Laura, thanks for hanging out.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, see you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to TRP's weekly podcast. If you happen to live on the eastern shore of Maryland and would like to participate in a conversation like this on Sunday mornings, we invite you to join us for our weekly service, Sundays at 11:15 a.m. at 1401 Camden Ave. We meet in a big, historic Methodist church, so if you show up, you see a bunch of marble and expensive organ, you're in the right place. If you'd like to know more about TRP, you can check out our website for more information, www.restoresby.org. And of course, if you resonated with what you have heard and would like to support us financially, you can visit give.restoresby.org. Until next time.